I want to share some thoughts that I have with you tonight on randomness. But I've got some sort of prepared remarks at the beginning, so let's just start with that. One of my favorite passages. In the beginning was the Logos, the logic, the organizing intelligence. And the logic, or the intelligence, was with God, and the logic was God. For the past 30 years, it's been my pleasure to be, and also my calling, I believe, to explore the deeper mysteries of God's creation as it relates to life. So I thank you for the warm invitation that ISCAS has extended to me to share some of these insights with you. In the summer of 1905, an obscure patent clerk, recently turned physicist, radically changed our world and our understanding of the world with one simple mathematics equation. You all know what it was. E equals mc squared. With this simple but ultimately profound statement, Albert Einstein revolutionized our understanding of the physical biological world, defining the basic elements of relativity and showing that matter and energy were really just different forms of the same thing. The ramifications of this revolutionary concept were enormous, ultimately sowing the seeds for the nuclear age that would follow in the 1930s and in the 1940s. Einstein summed up his work on relativity with one clear statement. He said, he was German, he said, "Alles ist relativ." All is relative. Tonight I would like to share with you another idea that is beginning to change the way I view the world and also the way I view and appreciate my Creator God. Alles ist Zufallscharakter. All is randomness. No doubt such a statement is bound to raise a few eyebrows. After all, words like relativity and randomness do not seem theologically congruent with our concept of a God who sets universal, unchanging standards and also displays unrivaled creativeness. But before you rise up here tonight and cry heresy, I would beg your indulgence for a few moments. Because just as Einstein's relativity theory has much more to it than meets the casual eye, so also I believe there is much more to this concept, alles ist Zufallscharakter. Indeed, I'm beginning to think that it has God's fingerprints all over it. Excuse me just a minute, Peter. What is this noise up here? Is that the wind or the rain or what?
Traffic.
Oh, traffic. Okay. Well, last night we spoke on the other side of Sydney and we had jet airplanes going over. So I'll do the best I can. That would probably be good, and because I really would like to be over here where I can use my hands and see you. Maybe we can do this. So my idea that I would like to share with you is that there may be much more to this concept of randomness than we typically understand. But in order to understand that better, it's important that we see a bigger perspective. My son Landon, we have four sons. My second son Landon, when he was about 8 or 10 years old, I was working in my office on a Saturday morning, and all of a sudden I heard him call from down in the basement, "Dad, Dad, come here, quick." And so I got up out of my chair and ran down to see what was going on. And I went into his room, and there he was standing in front of his wall, looking at this great big poster on the wall. Well, you all know what it was, one of those stereo cryptograms that were all the craze a few years ago. These big posters that looked just nothing but like random assembly of multicolored dots, a mosaic, just a sea of dots, lots of color. But you're supposed to be able to look at those, and if you look at them long enough or cross-eyed enough, you're supposed to be able to see some sort of image there. Well, I knew what those were, and I had kind of done them before, but it's been a long time. But Landon was all excited. He said, "Look, Dad," he said, "there's two sharks in there, big sharks underneath the ground, or underneath the water, and two dolphins, and one of them is jumping up out of the water, and there's this great big huge sailboat." And he was all excited that I would see that. So I said, "Well, okay, let me see." So he positioned me just the right distance from the wall. I took my place and I began to stare at that poster. And I looked, and I looked, and I looked, and then I tried to go cross-eyed. Couldn't see it. I just couldn't see it. I remember seeing the look in his eyes. He was so disappointed. He had been so excited. He had seen something that was not visible to just anyone. He had to see it by looking at it carefully. And he was anxious to share this with his father. And he was really disappointed that I couldn't see what he could see. Well, Landon's a good boy. He tells the truth. I have no doubt that there was probably something there, but I just was not able to see it. So I resolved in my mind that I would keep looking. So therefore, thereafter, for a couple of weeks, when I would go down to tuck the boys to bed at night or just down there for something else, I would just step over in front of the poster and just look at it for a few minutes. And just as before, nothing. Nothing was working. One day, a couple weeks later, everyone was gone. I was the only one in the whole house. And I don't know why, I was down by the room or something, and I stepped over in front of the poster, and I thought this would be safe. That way, no one would see my obviously compromised discerning abilities, or non-abilities. And I stepped in front of the poster, and I began to look at it. And as I was looking, all of a sudden, part of it just seemed to sort of shift backwards. At the same time, another part, looked like it was moving. The poster was moving, and then all of a sudden, whoosh, there it was. Two sharks swimming underneath the water, big ones. Two dolphins, one swimming under the water, another one jumping up with spray behind it, and a great big beautiful sailboat with flags flying, riding the ocean breeze. Everything that Landon had described to me, exactly as he had described it, but only visible to those who had eyes to see and the perseverance and the belief that there was actually something there to see. I think that story illustrates some of what I want to talk to you about tonight. Now, my students tell me that I'm a big picture person, but then they also say, but you like a lot of detail. And the reason that is, and it's really an accurate description, I really believe that it's important to see the big picture no matter what we are looking at. But I also understand that you've got to have the proper details in place in order to put them together in a way that you see an accurate big picture. Little things can make a big difference. You know that. You've all had experiences where one decision or one event completely changed your life. Okay? So, big picture perspective. So, in biology, I call this higher order thinking. And it's just really a concept of connecting the dots. If you do a jigsaw puzzle that has 1,000 pieces, you can get a pretty good picture of what things look like sometimes just by doing 3/4 of the dots or 90% of the dots. But sometimes one of the last pieces is sometimes really critical to see the big picture in the proper perspective. So even tonight, as we talk about these things, we're going to be talking about science and faith, biology, and an understanding of life. Even tonight, as I talk to you, I think that you will see some of these dots that I've identified here. Communication, science, language, culture, music. Now, we can't do the music tonight. We're not set up for that. But mathematics, religion, history, art, and certainly information science, computer science. Connecting these dots. Now, I'm a biology teacher. I teach microbiology and immunology primarily now, but I also teach the non-majors general biology class. These are for students that don't take science for any other reason. As a part of our liberal arts curriculum, they're required to take one biology course. So you have people coming from lots of different areas. Some are studying business, some are studying English, some are studying education, social sciences, all these different types of things. Now, so my challenge then is to communicate how life really works in simple enough language that they can understand it, but not so water it down that the complexity is lost. And we lose how dynamic and amazing it really is. And that's no small challenge. Now, people in the past have thought, if I ask them, what do you think about when you think biology? Often they think of, well, a frog. That's what they do. They dissect a frog when they're, in fifth or sixth grade or something. Or maybe a microscope. And 30 or 40 or 50 years ago or so, our whole understanding of biology pretty much was based upon this idea that you'd give a student a notepad and you'd send them out and you'd have them identify the things they saw in nature and draw them and classify them and put them into an organized scheme. That used to be what biology was about. It was sort of phylogeny and just keeping things ordered. Wow, have things ever changed? Today, if we want to understand biology, we have to understand the chemistry of what happens inside of each of our 100 trillion, each one of us, 100 trillion living cells. No small task. And so when I'm trying to teach biology and how life really works, my challenge really is sort of summarized in this equation here. Some of you remember this periodic table from your earlier schooling. For some of you who are not scientists, it's the sort of thing that you look at and you quickly try to forget as soon as possible. But when you look at the periodic table, it really has a logic and an order to it. And biologists know that the basic elements of all life, there are just a handful of them, things like phosphorus and nitrogen and carbon and sulfur and hydrogen. A few of these chemicals can associate into what we call biological molecules, and what life really is the chemistry of these biological molecules. So our challenge as educators in the life science is to try to make that shift from simple atoms, the basic building blocks of nature, to an individual who is sentient, who can think, be self-aware, and I would say, as a Christian, also God-aware. Spiritual element to our existence. You say, okay, that's a nice simple equation. Scientists like equations. But this is beguilingly deceptive in terms of the complexity of what goes on here. You'd think that the more we learn, it would begin to break out and, like a jigsaw puzzle, you get closer to the end and then you'd understand it all. But what we really discover is that, well, I put it this way, this is my experience, the more that I learn, that there's always more to learn. It just gets bigger. Francis Collins is a Christian scientist of my own ilk. He's the head of the Human Genome Project, the one that, you know, has really revolutionized genetics now. And he's written a book very similar principles and purposes as my own. And he says, many Christians are afraid that science is taking the mystery away from God. And I agree with Francis Collins completely when he says, that's not even close. There is plenty of mystery, and it's all here. When we go and we crack open a cell, we look inside, and we try to understand how the genes are expressed and how they are responsible for making us how we are, there's no lacking of mystery there. So we need not be afraid of that. Well, I tell my students that biology is, well, this is sort of the summary big picture statement. I say biology is bigger and smaller, faster and slower, in a way really, really simple, but in another way immensely and profoundly complex. Bigger, the astronomers tell us that we live in a universe that has approximately 100 billion with a B galaxies. We live in the Milky Way galaxy. 100 billion stars in each galaxy. Now, how do you begin to get your mind around that? So the world is bigger, the world is smaller. I'm a microbiologist. So I live everything about life that you cannot see, that's what I know best. Okay? Things like viruses and bacteria and genes and proteins and even biochemical molecules. Bigger, smaller, faster. Okay, remember I said life is chemistry. We understand the chemistry of what goes on inside of a cell. It gives us hints and clues as to how that cell functions and how life is. But if we just leave it to the chemist, it won't work. Chemists can't do it by themselves. The chemistry is too slow. And so in order for life to exist, there needs to be catalytic molecules that we call enzymes. Now they're proteins and they're consequences of our genes. We'll talk about those in a minute. These enzymes, they function by recognizing, they're just sort of floating in the aqueous solution of our cells, and they have to recognize a chemical specifically, nothing else, just one, have to specifically recognize it, bind it in a specific way, break it usually, let it loose, and then it can repeat the process again. Bind, specifically, break, release. Bind, specifically, break, release. And it can do this at rates of tens of thousands of times per second. How do you get your mind around that? But it's absolutely essential for life to exist. Without those enzymes, we're dead. Okay? So bigger, smaller, faster, but also slower. The geologists look at the fossil record and the rocks, and they say that the average speciation event time frame is approximately 160,000 years. Oh, how can we do that? We have trouble just relating back to the time of Christ 2,000 years ago. Bigger, smaller, faster, slower. Really simple. Did you know that in information systems like computers and the internet and all these things, everything, all of it ultimately reduces to whether you have a zero or a one. It's a binary code, 2 bits. Okay, zero or one. Well, in the information of life, it's very similar, but we actually have 4 chemicals. Adenine, guanine, cytosine, and thymine. And so just as in information technology, different sequences of zeros and ones give rise to everything that we see in information, in our information age. So the different sequences of adenine, guanine, cytosine, and thymine, just 4 chemicals, give rise to all the diversity of life. From a herpes virus, to a honeybee, to a horse, and to a human. We are what we are because of the gene sequences that we have of just those 4 bases. But all life uses the same 4 codes, just like the zeros and the ones. So, really pretty simple, but ultimately profound and complex, because by organizing those things together in different sequences, look at the diversity of life that we have on our planet now. It's just incredible. And then these geologists and paleontologists, they look back and they say, but over 99% of all species that have ever existed on the planet are already extinct. So there's an infinite number of possibilities that are... Now you see that because with zeros and ones, you see all the possibilities that we see on the internet with 4 bases. I mean, it's just way more potential. And we see it exhibited in life. One last thing about this. So when we look at the big picture of life, also consider, I tell my students that not only do you have all these things going on at the same time, they're also integrated. So they're not just one happening independent of all the others. This is happening over here with this over here, and they're also integrated, both horizontally but vertically. And so what we see then is, biology speaking, is you see a design, and then you look carefully, there's a design within that design. And then you look carefully, there's a design within that design. And then you crack it down and deeper and deeper and deeper, and it's just a multi-level of design. So you see me, you see a head, arms, but then you look inside, there are organs, and then tissues, and then cells, and that's just the beginning, because once you crack open the cells, all kinds of different levels of structure from that point on. And I know you're not interested in hearing those tonight. Okay? So design within design within yet more design. Amazing stuff. Alright, so if we're trying to understand how life really works, and I think the reason I think this is important, because when we're talking about science-faith issues or creation-evolution issues, it's really, do you really understand how life works biologically? It's sort of like an important dot to include in the repertoire, right? Because if we don't understand how life works, how can we intelligently try to incorporate it with our faith? So what are some of the barriers to this type of learning? Well, first of all, limiting the input of new doubts, new information. Have you ever met anybody who said, no thank you, I have all the information I need? You're chuckling because we've all met those individuals. But what happens when that's the response? All learning stops. That's it. You're dead, but you can never progress any further. Second, focusing on the wrong dots. C.S. Lewis in his book Mere Christianity described the situation in a different context, but he said sometimes if you're going down the wrong path, you're following the wrong signpost, sometimes the best thing to do is to just go back to a point of really solid basis, you know where you're at, and then progress from there down the right direction. that's really quite contrary to American male psychology. If we get lost, we don't want to admit that we're really lost. And then I said that to one of the other talks this week, and they said, well, Australian males are like that too. Third barrier, imprecise, and I think this one's big, imprecise definitions and misunderstanding of information. I call them dots. And that kind of goes with this last one, language and communication. I've taught biology now for 27 years at a Christian college right in the Midwest of the United States, the heartland of fundamental Christianity. And so I watched this dynamic go on. Really, I think it's one of the reasons that I believe God called me to write the book. Because I saw the miscommunication that was going on, and I said, that was so unnecessary. Why didn't they talk the same language and take the time to understand each other before they started attacking each other? It seems pretty simple, doesn't it? But what I've observed is that this, I don't think it's the science. I mean, the evolution, science, biology, our understanding there is just going to be what it is. And I think our religious faith is going to be what it is for the most part. Okay, but what I think I've seen occurring is that people are not understanding the terms that the other person uses. So we end up just walking through time and talking right past one another. One of my faculty members calls it the dialogue of the deaf. You're hearing the words, but they're not really registering in that way. Well, there's two components then of communicating information, and I put them on two levels here. One is what I call personal. So think about it now. I know a lot about microbiology and immunology. So if you ask me a question about how the immune system responds to make antibodies and protect us from disease, I can tell you way more than you'd ever like to know. But the reason that I know that so well is that I've had all these quarter of a century of time to accumulate dots, to find the right balance, the right definitions, and to put those together in a way that we have a nice, clear, coherent picture. That takes a long time sometimes. Okay? So when we talk about personal communication, I've got all these dots in my head. So for me to understand the concept, it's pretty easy. I mean, all the data points are there. I know they're there because I put them there. But the challenge then is for me to communicate both to my students and to you the same concepts that I have with the same degree of weighting, so you can have just as clear a picture of how life works as I have. And then that's the problem, communication. Because the words that we use, and we're limited by language. I mean, if we could just be God the Creator, we could just, you know, speak in tongues or something. Maybe something that everybody would understand. Okay, but we're limited to our language. And if I say, for example, to one of my biology colleagues, what do you think of some of these terms, like science, he and I will be on the same page. If I say to one of my English faculty colleagues, what do you think of science, they'll have some understanding of science because they're English professors, but it'll be different than my understanding of science is. And the same thing with students and with lay people. They have different understanding of what science is, what it does, and what it can say authoritatively and what it cannot say authoritatively. All right, so with this miscommunication. And then, if I speak to a student who is majoring in education or specializing in education or social studies, the response that they have to science is F-E-A-R. They're afraid of science. Let me get that biology or physical science class as quickly as I can, get out of there. I don't want to have to do this anymore. Maybe Australian students aren't quite that afraid, but we have many students who are just afraid of science. It's hard for them to get good grades. They just don't want to be there. Well, look at some of the other things. I call this the modern-day Tower of Babel. We're just not talking to each other in language that we can understand. So another term, evolution. Creationist. Even Christian and mutation. I mean, mutation is one of those words. You see down here I've got emotional obstacles, because the obstacle for communication, in my view, is not just our definition, but also the fact that many terms, our language, our words, they get emotional baggage added onto them. So if mutation, for example, that one always has negative baggage to it, emotionally. After all, how would you feel if I called you a mutant? You know, it doesn't exactly elicit feelings of warmth and endearment, you know, to the person who's addressing it that way. Even words like Christian. And I'm a Christian. I went to speak at a medical school as a visiting professor last summer in the Caribbean island. And it was St. Martin's Island. And St. Martin's Island is half inhabited by the French and half inhabited by the Dutch. Okay, very European, you know, flavor to the island. And while I was there, the Christian Medical and Dental Association group of medical students, they discovered that I was there. They'd heard about my book, so they asked if I would give them a public lecture. So I did. It was a great turnout, but they weren't all Christian students. And there were faculty and others who were just curious. And what I discovered is that although in a Christian college setting where I teach, the word Christian is always regarded as warm and fuzzy, in St. Martin's Island, it's not uniformly regarded as warm and fuzzy. The background, the baggage that we carry with these types of things. Tremendous emotional barriers. Sharon Begley is a writer, used to be a writer for the Wall Street Journal and now for Newsweek magazine. She's a science writer. She wrote an article a while back, and I never quite explained this real clear. I probably should work on it before I talk about it in public, but they did an experiment with human subjects where they wired them up so that on a screen they could project what parts of the brain were being activated at different times. Then they fed the human subjects questions that were designed to stimulate the rational centers of the brain. And then they sent them, and when they did that, the rational centers of the brain, you know, fired up and you could see the lighter color on the image. And then they did the same thing for questions designed to stimulate emotional centers of the brain. And sure enough, that one stimulated the appropriate area. But then they did something kind of sneaky where they would ask a question that really only required the rational centers of the brain to respond, but they had attached an emotional baggage clip to it. And when they asked the question, knowing that the subject was going to make that association, guess what they saw? Yeah. In Sharon Begley's words, she says, the emotional centers of the brain lit up like Vegas. And the rational centers were silent. Ooh. Now what does this teach me as an educator when I'm communicating to a classroom of 230 students that come from a tremendous diverse background? Some of them from ultra-conservative, six-day creationist families where they've been taught all of their life that evolution is evil, incompatible with belief in God, and if anyone believes in evolution, well, they're going someplace different than they think they're going. Okay? So I have that. I have a more moderate Christian perspective. I also have some that are agnostic, and even some who are atheists. So I have 230 students, and my goal is not just to talk to one group. My goal is to talk to them all. I want to touch them and engage them wherever they are at. Okay, no small challenge. So, but when I find that I'm teaching evolution, because I have to do it, it's biology, we only have three lectures. But three lectures on it, in that whole thing, it's just an overview. But when some of my more conservative Christian students who come from these conservative homes, when they hear that, they're afraid. And sometimes they lash out. They respond emotionally. But now you see, based on what I've described to you, I understand better now how to respond to them because they can't help it. They've been told, they've attached that negative emotional response, and when they hear it, it's just automatic. Now, the good news is that when you followed Sharon Begley's experiment, they found that the rational centers could be coaxed to respond, but it took time in education, learning. Of course, there has to be an openness to learn. So I guess maybe that's the wisdom in my father's and mother's saying to me when I was a kid, when they would say, always count to 10 before you respond. Think before you act. Knowing that it's the emotional centers that are driving us initially, not the rational centers. But you see what that does for me in terms of interacting with students who come from different backgrounds? I can empathize with them. And I can say, wherever you are at, that's okay. We'll start there and begin to progress forward. Well, let's look at this one term. This is the one that usually is the most controversial. Evolution. Students ask me, is evolution true? Sometimes the church leaders ask me, is evolution true? But sometimes those questions are more like accusations instead of questions. But evolution, is it true? And I say, yes, yes, no, and maybe. Real definitive guy. But yes, yes, no, and maybe. Evolution changed through time, generically speaking. Sydney, Australia, has evolved through time. Your traffic system has evolved through time. Yeah. Is it getting better or worse? So I didn't intend that. I just said it seriously and I started hearing chuckles coming out of you. Evolution, genetic mechanisms for biological development. Yeah. Clearly demonstrable. We can do that. Evolution. The definition that says that it is atheistic. That's your Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, very popular science writers who claim that if the random, purposeless laws of nature and evolution are true, then God is not real. No. When Richard Dawkins knows better. He knows that when you take scientific data, you can reach certain conclusions about those relating to that data. But when you take a step that he's taken and said that therefore excludes God, he has stepped outside the legitimate boundaries of science and now has entered the domain of philosophy. He knows better. But he keeps on doing it. It sells lots of books. Alright. So no. And number three, chemical evolution. Chemical evolution is asking a different question than the second one, the biological development. Chemical evolution is asking, how did the first life on this planet come to be? And I shared this with the group last night. When I was writing my book, I read up on some of this stuff, and I looked at the proceedings of a recent conference of chemical evolutionary biologists. And the sort of executive summary afterwards was pretty simple. They said, we don't know. And so that really is the consensus in the biological community. We don't know how the first life arrived on this planet. This is what we do know. We know that between 3.5 and 3.8 billion years ago, there was on this planet very simple single-celled life. They're very similar to the cyanobacteria group that we know in microbiology. You guys here in Australia have an interesting distinction in that regard, in that the fossilized remains of those are called stromatolites and they were discovered on your shores. Okay? So, but you see, that's a different question, though, than is evolution, biological development, true? So if one wants to be opposed to evolution, here's one that you can take that position and you can stand pretty confidently, at least for the time being. Yes, yes, no, and maybe. Now, do you see how easy it is, then, for people who are talking about creation, evolution, and science and faith to get confused? Because if I'm talking about number two, and you're talking about number three, dialogue of the deaf. And what happens is people begin to get angry and frustrated when they don't understand each other. And it just amplifies and gets worse. I understand that this creation, evolution, and science, faith thing is not such a big deal here in Australia for you. I'm happy for you. The well has not been so deeply poisoned. So right now, all we hear in the United States primarily is Richard Dawkins' atheistic message and six-day creationist message. And the irony here is really amazing, because Richard Dawkins, the atheistic scientific message on this issue is this. If evolution, which involves random natural law, is true, that therefore excludes God. That's that message. Got it? If evolution, which includes random processes, is true, that therefore excludes God. Now, consider the sad, sad, tragic irony of the next statement. The six-day creationists agree with that atheistic pronouncement. If evolution, which includes random processes, is true, that therefore excludes God. The six-day literal fundamental creationists have adopted, they bought the bait, they bought the atheistic conclusion. Now everyone knows in a court case that if you have two attorneys who are going to be arguing and battling out, the attorney who can set the parameters at the best and establish the basic underlying assumptions is the one who is most likely to win the argument. Fact. But you see how tragic that is then? You have two groups at opposite ends of the spectrum in terms of belief in God who have agreed on a basic assumption which is false. Weird. Okay. So my students ask me sometimes, is evolution a theory or a fact? Now here's the definition stuff again, because when they say theory, typically they mean a theory as sort of like, well, a guess. So it's just a theory. Well, that just makes scientists cringe, because we don't look at theory that way at all. We look at theory much differently. So the students will say to me, is evolution, I say, is a theory or a fact? And I'll say, evolution is a theory and a fact. Fact. Biological evolution has occurred and is still occurring. Theory. A theory is that accumulation of facts from a variety of disciplines, might be geology, chemistry, paleontology, genetics, microbiology, all of those facts have to support the unifying principle in the middle. That's the theory. And the theory cannot stand if it does not accommodate all the facts. Now, you don't always get 100%, but I mean, you've got, you see what I'm saying? So from a scientific perspective, we don't consider a theory a guess or just your opinion. A theory is even stronger in some ways than a fact. So you see what I'm talking about here in terms of the language? I'm here all the way over here in Australia, and I guess what I'm going to say to you is that this is not a crisis of biology. That is what it is. It's going to change. It's not going to change. It's going to continue to move forward. Our understanding is going to improve. And I don't think it's really even a crisis of faith. It's a crisis of communication and understanding one another. All right, so the crux of the issue, these are just my views. The scientists are suspicious that Christians want to insert religious beliefs into science. They are really, really wary of that. And guess why? Because in the United States, Christians are trying to do that all the time. And the scientists recognize that that can never be acceptable. The scientific pursuit of truth in the physical and the biological, where they are qualified to speak, can never be allowed to be vetoed by a religious belief. Because what happens when we walk down that door or down that road? Is it going to be the Christian belief that vetoes it? Or is it going to be Muslim or Jewish or Hindu? Where does it end? In other words, the scientists recognize that science must be free to pursue truth wherever it leads, in the physical and the biological domain. On the other hand, Christians fear that science seeks to remove God from the picture altogether. Now, is this fear legitimate? I don't think so, but I can sure understand why they think that. Once again, you've got Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris and others now, very vocal scientists who are making that pronouncement. If God, if evolution and natural law are all there is, or if those are responsible for the generation and the development of life, then God's out of the picture. And so, you know, I'm thinking of many of the friends that I know that don't have any science background at all. And these so-called authorities in science are pronouncing to them over the radio waves and in books all over the world that basic atheistic principle. Evolution, random processes, incompatible with belief in God. And their children are going to school and they're afraid because science has such great power and authority to speak in our cultures. And it does in the physical and biological. And so they're afraid that somebody is going to rob their son or daughter or their child of their belief in God. It's very understandable. So my question, are these suspicions and fears warranted? I think not, but I understand why we've gotten to that point. So my question really is, who will stop that cycle, that extreme, one extreme or the other extreme? Can we find the middle road? Well, I guess that's why I'm here. I want to talk to you now then, in that context, about this term randomness. There are lots of people, Christian scientists now, who are talking about evolution and Christian faith. And I'm doing it sort of tangentially. But I think my unique contribution to this overall dialogue is this consideration of the word randomness. Because if we don't get this right, I'm concerned that there is no hope to ever find peace between science and faith. When you look at the definitions of random, you get these types of definitions. Look in Webster's Dictionary. I actually took these from Webster's Dictionary. These are the types of words that you see in different dictionaries. Haphazard, coincidence, chance, and purposeless. And if you talk to a college student, they'll say, oh, it's just random. And that's kind of what they're thinking, this first definition. But if you look in the dictionary, you'll see that there's a point two. There's actually a second definition that's listed. And that definition goes like this. Equal opportunity of occurrence. So in that sense, biology is really simply nothing more. These random processes are nothing more than an equal opportunity process. All the different possibilities are out there, they're considered and chosen. We call that natural selection. Okay? So this takes on a different light then, because it doesn't necessarily mean that random equals purposeless. Because what we observe is that there are many random processes in biology that result in tremendously useful purposes. So there's the empirical evidence. I mean, in the U.S., there's a state right in the middle of the country called Missouri. And Missouri is called the Show Me State. In other words, they don't take anything unless you can actually show it. Show it. Demonstrate it. Give me the evidence. Okay? And so when we look at biological mechanisms, there is this empirical sense that we can show that random processes are a part of it. See why this is so important, though? Because if we buy that atheistic description, that descriptor, that random processes of evolution are contrary to belief in God, and even the fundamentalist voices have adopted that, there's no hope for God. If evolution is identified as being true, and I'm going to share some of the compelling evidence with you in just a moment, both sides of the equation leave no place for God. So my role, I think, my unique contribution to this whole thing is saying we can look at this term, this language term of randomness differently in a way that keeps God permanently in the picture. So why is randomness, why is it so crucial that it be clearly understood? Empirical, the show me stuff. Because random processes are clearly observable in biology in a lot of ways. All right, I'm just going to show you four examples. A couple quick ones, and then we'll go into evolution as the last example. First, biochemical and physical processes. I wish I had a match and a piece of tissue paper. I've done this object lesson before. Take the tissue paper, just a little bit of it, strike a match and just touch it at the bottom, and it burns fast. Real thin paper. I got to let it go, and it's burned up and gone before it hits the floor. And then I ask my students, what happened? They get all kinds of interesting responses. And of course, there's always a jokester that says something that has no relevance at all. But what happened? And they say, well, the paper burned. Well, what happened? And go in more to it. Well, the paper was converted to heat and light and then the carbon dioxide and water. And I'll take a little deeper. So, well, actually, it's, you know, paper is composed of cellulose, a chemical. And the cellulose is converted to carbon dioxide and water. Well, really, the cellulose is made up of glucose molecules. So it's burning glucose and converting it to carbon dioxide and water. And all that's interesting in detail, but the point is, what happened? Why did that happen? I mean, have you ever thought about that? When you light a match to paper, why does it burn? Here's the answer. There is a universal law of our universe that is a direction-giving law. It's sort of like the river. The river flows only in one direction and provides force only in that direction. There is a river that sort of establishes time and space and everything else that goes on in the universe, that's just the law of our nature. We do the best we can to describe this force as the second law of thermodynamics. Now, typically it's defined as moving things toward maximum disorder or randomness. That's a little bit of a confusing concept, okay? But it is an important process in biological systems, and not just biology, but in everything. Because this universal driver that provides directionality to all of our world, including biology and life, is absolutely essential. If there is no second law of thermodynamics, there is no life, there's no chemistry, there's no physics, there's no movement, there's nothing. You say, well, what's nothing? Just nothing. There's no life. So there is this driving force, just like a river flowing downstream, the energy can be captured with a dam and used for a while. Okay, that's kind of what we got. We got this stuff moving through time, and it can be captured, and from that life can be generated. But I guess basically the bottom line is that we need it. Second example is the random processes that occur during sperm and egg formation. If you take two parents and they have a child, what are the odds, given this random processes of chromosome segregation during sperm and egg formation, what are the odds that they will have another child that is exactly the same, basically an identical twin? You say, well, there's 23 chromosomes contributed from mom and 23 from dad, so maybe it's 23 plus 23 is 46, or something like that. The mathematicians know where this goes. It works like this. Inside of my cells, I mean your size cells, you have 46 chromosomes, 23 from mom, 23 from your dad. So you have a chromosome number 1 from your dad, chromosome number 1 from your mom, and a chromosome number 2 from your dad, a chromosome 2 from your dad, from your mom. And during sperm and egg formation, Gregor Mendel described this a long time ago, called law of independent assortment. During sperm and egg formation, when those chromosomes are segregating, so the sperm always has 23 of one and 23 of, you know, the other, when it does that, those chromosomes segregate independently. So what that means is that chromosome number 1 from mom can either go this way or this way. And chromosome number 1 from dad can either go this way or this way. And if this one goes here, then this one has to go here. That's simple. It's a 1 and 2. But what if the same thing happens for chromosome 2? This one can go here or here. This one can go here or here. And it's completely independent of number 1. You do the math, and then you do the combination of that happened with an egg formation, and it also happened with a sperm formation, and you put it together, and the odds of having a sibling that is exactly the same as the other child is easily greater, and this is an underestimate, easily greater than 1 in 100 trillion. The math just boggles your mind. Now, many of you who, if you have a sibling that you don't like very much, can take great comfort in this, because you can be assured that they really are not exactly like you. Okay? Random process. And it turns, and I can't go here tonight, but that randomization event is really, really important for life. But that's another whole series of lectures. All right, the third example is with antibodies. This is my field. Here's the way this works. We have a problem. We have, the Human Genome Project came out a few years ago, and now it's been identified that human beings have approximately 23,000 genes. Now, gene codes for a protein, and the protein carries out some important biological function for the cell. And we know that each one of those genes, almost all of them, are critically important. So the gene for hemoglobin makes the hemoglobin protein, and that carries out a very important biological function. And we know it's critical because you have occasional people who have a mutation in that gene, and it results in sickle cell anemia and other types of problems. All kinds of genetic diseases. So we know those 23,000 are all important. And so they make these proteins, the proteins carry out their function, life carries on. But we have a problem when it comes to immunity to infectious agents. Microbiologists do the calculations, and it looks like there are perhaps as many as 1 to 2 to 3 million different potential invaders out there who can make us ill or cause us trouble in one way or another. So just take 2 million. 2 million possible problem makers out there. And antibodies, these guys, They're proteins. They come from genes. But we only have 23,000 genes. So how do we make a million different specificities of the antibodies to protect us against all those different things? It's impossible, right? The answer is randomness. You have a small number of core antibody genes, and it turns out that there's a group of white blood cells called B cells that during their development, they randomly rearrange these antibody genes in such a way that it produces an infinite number, almost, of different possible specificities, just from a handful of precursors. So that means we only need a few genes to protect ourselves against virtually anything. So I used this example with Peter last night, so it's on my mind. If a landing module came back from Mars after we sent it, and it brought back some material that had never been on the planet before, I could be almost, provided it has certain, you know, biochemical properties, I could be certain that it could not make Peter ill. You know, it could get in. Peter already has these antibodies and specificities in advance. Now, so it's an amazing thing. We all have them. So we already have the ability to respond to things that we'll probably never ever see. That's why an individual who has a type of leukemia, like a B-cell lymphoma, multiple myeloma, sometimes the treatment for that is they will do really, really stringent chemotherapy. And they'll just, the goal is to kill all the cancer cells, but in doing so, to make sure they get them all, they've got to knock out all the bone marrow cells as well. So basically, this person will be a completely non-functioning individual in terms of immunity, and they won't be able to survive. And so the cure then, hopefully, is to come back with a bone marrow transplant of non-cancerous bone marrow cells, and they just stick a needle in your vein and just inject the bone marrow cells, not that many actually, and they'll go into the blood, and they will home into the bone marrow and begin to grow and divide there, and within just a few weeks, sometimes a few months, that little bone marrow transplant has completely reconstituted the immune system specificities, and now we're immune to all those millions of specificities again. All because of randomness. Now, is that a purposeless thing? Clearly it is not. It accomplishes an amazing purpose, even beyond our wildest imagination. Let's talk about evolution for just a moment. Now, some time back, the only evidence for evolution was from the fossil record, so the geologists had a monopoly on that. But there were lots of gaps, because fossils don't form easily. Hard to find. Most of the time, you'd never expect to see any fossils. So there were some gaps there. But nevertheless, it told a pretty compelling story. But you all know that if you're trying to sort of shore up a case or a concept and put things together, the best evidence to build that case is not to bring more data from the same source. The best evidence is to have completely independent verification from a different source. And that's exactly what we have now from the field of genetics. As I said, the Human Genome Project was deciphered and reported first in the year 2003. So now, for the first time in all history, we have a letter-by-letter code of the entire human genome. And in addition, we can compare that to other humans and also to other species. So we can compare a human, we can do the frog DNA, we can do the mouse DNA, the chimpanzee DNA, we can do them all. And they're all being done right here as we speak now. So for the first time in all history, we have the ability to analyze our history genetically in ways that we've never been able to do before. Now, I want to just give you two examples of that, but I'm going to do a timeout, so if you'll bear with me, because I think this is helpful, and I also want to make sure I get this in, because there's a really clear misunderstanding out there about how evolution works. And I hear this all the time teaching at the Christian College, and it works something like this. They say, the random mutations do not create new information, and so evolution is impossible. That betrays a tremendous scientific naivety and misunderstanding of how this whole process works. So I have one slide to help you understand how evolution actually does accumulate information over generations and lead to new and productive capabilities. It's a process that we call gene duplication and then divergence. So we first have to make a backup copy. Remember I said that we have 23,000 genes? Okay, the implication based upon genetic disease is that every one of those genes is critical to the functioning of our cells, or most of them. And so if the people are right when they say, if you randomly mutate an existing gene, it's not likely to create things better, it's likely to make things worse. And that's exactly what we observe with human genetic diseases. But what if you do what the computer scientists do? If they're afraid that they might lose some data or corrupt the data, they make a backup copy. Indeed, that's exactly what the DNA does. It makes, not on rare occasions, it makes on routine, in routine fashion, it makes backup copies of existing genes. And so, for example, here's a chromosomal segment. You see the yellow part. A duplication then will just double the amount that's here. And we can see that diagrammatically over here, genes C and D, present here, duplicated, and usually they're inserted right next door to each other in a tandem repeat. Sorry, I'm losing my voice. I'm going to still try to project. And so what we end up with is genetic a chromosome that contains two copies of C and two copies of D. Now this is ingenious, because what it means is that one set of C and D can continue to carry out the normal biological function that the cell requires, and the other one is free to experience the random mutational events that might lead to new and productive functionality. Now, if you looked at this and you thought about it a little bit, you'd reach the conclusion, well, if that's how the information amplifies and changes during the process of evolution, you'd predict that there would be a whole bunch of genes within us that would be related to one another because they were derived from pre-existing genes. And that's exactly what we observe. Genes exist in families. Okay? All right, so thank you. I'm better when I have a lapel mic. I can just do my normal mumbling. All right, I just wanted to throw that in because there's often a lot of misunderstanding about that. And this is basically the process, very simplistically, but this is the basic upon process by which it works. Okay, two examples of evolutionary information that have been derived from the field of genetics that I think are very enlightening. And there are thousands of these. Just grabbing two. Pretty compelling cases, though. This is a comparison of the chromosomes from several different ape species, including humans. So we have human, chimpanzee, gorilla, and orangutan. Now, if you look at one of these other chromosomes over here, chromosome 5, you see the banding patterns identify where the genes are basically the same. Okay? And if you look at that, you reach the conclusion these genes are basically the same. Now, already that's going to lead us to a tentative conclusion of common ancestry, because if you look at all the different species, you don't see this. This is only in the most closely related species. But this isn't the proof. This is just consistent with. Okay? But look at this one over here. Human chromosome number 2. Uh-oh. You see where this is going, don't you? If you look at the banding patterns for the top half of human chromosome number 2 and the banding patterns for one of the chimp chromosomes and the other apes as well, they line up almost perfectly. And the bottom half of human chromosome number 2 lines up almost perfectly with the ape chromosome on the other side. The chimps, the orangutans, the baboons, they have 48 chromosomes. Humans have 46. This is why. There's no doubt, so it's very clear, that human chromosome number 2 is a fusion product of a primordial ape chromosome. Two of them. We call them telomere to telomere fusions. They're very rare events, but we know they happen. You can see them happening in all other species. Okay, so you have one end of the chromosome has attached to the other. It's used up. There's all kinds of interesting things I would love to talk to you about relating to this, but we just don't have time tonight. Tremendous ramifications for the human species and things like that. But I'll point to one other thing here. You see these little inflection points right there and right there? Those are called centromeres. Those are the points, remember I said chromosomes had to spread to daughter cells? and when a skin cell divides, it has to divide so it gets the same chromosomes over here as it does over here. And that has to happen with a very high degree of fidelity, virtually no mistakes. And you see that in children who are born with chromosomal imbalances. I mean, most of the time they're just not even viable. We have a few cases like Down syndrome, Turner syndrome, where they can still survive. It's because this gene balance is really important. Now look at chromosome number 2. You would predict that when this first happened, and this certainly would have been the case, it would have 2 centromeres. One here, and another one down here. But what we observe is that this is the only one that's present. And it coincides precisely with the position of this one over here. Okay? Now you say, well then what happened to this one? Well, we can look more closely. Just like Lannan looking at the maze of dots, we can look more closely, and we do the actual base sequence, the adenines, guanines, cytosine, and thymines of that chromosome, and when you look in this region, we know that there are certain compositions of base sequences that are always present at centromere region. And what it tells us is that that is a fossilized centromere region. It used to be a centromere. Have you heard of this thing geologically called Pangaea? Thing where the continental drift across the plate tectonics. Some geologists put this data, I guess, together some years ago, and then they ran the computers backwards through millions of years, and they watched, sure enough, Africa and South America begin to move back toward each other, and then they fit. But then when they looked more closely, they saw something even more amazing. Not only did the continents fit, but the mountain ranges and the river valleys and other geological terrains fit too. So you saw the proof within the proof. Wow. That's kind of what we got here. This proof within the proof. Now let's look again. Here's another example. What do pufferfish, which have a 400 million year evolutionary history, have in common with human beings? Well, the answer is a lot, but also it doesn't have a lot, too. But one of the things that it has in common is that they both have a functional Huntington's gene. You've heard of Huntington's disease, haven't you? Well, Huntington's gene is a normal functioning gene that we all have. Individuals who have a mutation in the Huntington's gene have the disease state. So we know it's there. Well, both the pufferfish, and us have that. The other thing is that when you look at genes, it's all, you know, everything's always more complicated and complex when you look deeper. Genes are not actually just a linear sequences of dots and dashes, G's, T's, C's, and A's, but rather they're like little pieces of genes within the gene. And those are the parts that actually end up being in the protein and giving it its function. That's more than we need to know, but I just wanted to identify that that's there. Those are called exons. And so those little pieces of information within the gene, turns out that the pufferfish and the human have exactly the same number of exons located at exactly the same position in the same sequence. Again, consistent with common ancestry, but not proof. But where's the proof? This chromosome 2 thing I just showed you and what I'm about to show you is the strongest evidence I've ever seen. It's just, I don't know how you can see it any other way. Here it is. You have to listen, you have to hold on with me deep here for a second, because this is subtle, but it's profound. You see these little green dashes here? These green dashes are the positions of what we call their residual fossilized viral inserts, called retrotransposons. Sometimes call them jumping genes. Okay, there are different families of these, so we're just going to focus on this one. So these retrotransposons, these are ancient virus pieces of DNA that have been inserted into our DNA millions of years ago, or at least hundreds of thousands of years, a long time ago. Okay? They've been inserted a long time ago. Now, we know that this happens because we have lots of viruses even here today who do the same thing, the HIV virus. The first thing it does when it gets inside of us is it makes a copy of its DNA and it inserts its DNA into our DNA so that we can't tell that the virus is even there. Because every time that cell divides now, it copies the virus DNA too. It's really insidious. It's tricky. But every once in a while, after a virus does that, the virus gene will experience a random mutation so that it becomes non-functional. It can't produce virus particles. it can still reproduce itself, the DNA itself, but it can't produce the whole virus particle. That's what these types of structures are. The residual remnants, fossilized remnants of an ancient virus insert. Here's the next tricky thing. Now watch carefully. Imagine you have a sequence of DNA spread out like this, and you've got this retrotransposon, that is virus sequence that is inserted, been inactivated, and now is a permanent part of the genome of that cell. They have the ability occasionally, on really rare occasions, it only happens over long periods of time, to make a copy of themselves. So we'll let this be the copy. The copy comes out, it leaves the original there, and the new copy is free to insert anywhere in the genome. And where it inserts, this is really important, where it inserts is completely random. Just wherever it happens to fall, there it inserts. And when it inserts, now it becomes a permanent part of the genome. Every time the cell divides, it reproduces that too. And later, this one could reproduce again, and this one could. And over a long period of time, what you see is multiple inserts of the original insert beginning to fill up the genome. Uh-oh. Because when we look at the human DNA, only about 1-2% of the human DNA actually is the coding information for genes that make the proteins that make us what we are. Over 70% of the rest of the information are this parasitic DNA. It's filling our DNA up. It's filling us up with these nonsense pieces of genetic information. Okay, now, got all that then? The key is that they do that and they randomly insert. Now watch carefully, because here's the proof then for common ancestry. When we look at that and we compare the Huntington gene and the human gene, we find that 95% of the retrotransposons that are found in the chimpanzee genome are also found in the human Huntington gene genome. Think of it like this, if that's getting past you. Think of it like this. I'm a professor. I sign a paper. It's a 25-page paper. And somebody does the paper and they turn it in, and I'm reading papers, and all of a sudden I see one that looks kind of similar to one I saw before. Yes, I've seen that before. I'm going to do this all straight. Yes, I've seen this before. I'm trying to get it. I'm not going to make it. I've seen this before. Now, there's lots of different ways I could really look more closely to see if it really is a copy of someone else's work. You know, here's the original source, and now here's something that's really from the same source. But what if I looked in the computer terminal of the original source, and I looked in there, and I found on page 1, 6, 10, 14, and 18, I found that their computer, their computer pad had a problem, and when it printed a T, it printed a double T. Random mistakes through the paper. And then I take the other paper and I look, uh-oh, it's got the same thing. That second student gets an F. Because there's no other way to look at it. Okay, that's what we have here with these random inserts. Now I've just given you two examples. There are thousands of other examples, and the more information is coming every day. So what are we supposed to do with this as Christian scientists and Christian biologists? Should we tell our students just ignore it? It's not real? Should we tell them it's incompatible with their faith? I believe that God is the creator of all, the creator of life, even the majestic life at the molecular level. If he's the author of all, he is the author of this. Should we just pretend it's not there? I cannot do that with professional or personal integrity. So, but let's help them. Let's try to give them some help. So let's go back then, because these are random process examples I just talked to you about. Okay, random processes working in biology that show us things that are real. But let me take it just a bit deeper. Do we really know what random means? Look at this sequence. Does that look random to you? Now if you look at it, take a fourth grader, someone who's just early in school, hasn't had much math, that's random. But if you look a little closer, you say, well, wait a minute now, there's some doublets of fours and ones and twos, maybe that's not random after all. And then if you look a little closer, there's other structure there. Did you see that at first? So, you see, sometimes what appears to be random to us may in fact not be random at all. We just don't know how to see it properly. I think Jesus called that seeing into a glass darkly. I see this all the time in biology. There are things we don't understand. It doesn't mean that there's not meaning there. It just means that we don't understand how to look at it yet. We're learning. What about this one? Is this one random? Anybody? There's some mathematicians in here, I think. Anybody recognize this?
You add, you keep adding.
Yeah.
The one.
Yeah. Very well-known sequence called the Fibonacci sequence. The Fibonacci sequence goes like this. 0 plus 1 is 1, 1 plus 1 is 2, 1 plus 2 is 3, then 5 and 8 and so forth. In the Chronicles of Narnia, you can tell I like C.S. Lewis. In the Chronicles of Narnia, Aslan the lion is talking to the children, and the children are concerned because it looks like Aslan's going to die. And Aslan's trying to reassure them that it's okay, and he speaks of a deeper magic. Is there a deeper magic to a Fibonacci sequence? The mathematicians think it's cool just for itself, but there's more. Flower petals. One petal, two petals, three petals, five, eight, 13, 21, 34. There are many other examples in biology where we can see Fibonacci sequences taking place. How does that connect? I have not a clue, but it's something that's going on that I'd like somebody to explain to me. Well, by now you know that I'm playing with you, so you know this is not a random number. But look at this. If we take this sequence that looks random and we split it up into triplets, then it looks like this. And then if we do something sneaky, like assign each number a nucleotide base in the DNA, adenine, guanine, cytosine, and thymine, remember the zeros and ones of our DNA, it looks like this, TAC, CAC, etc. That's a DNA sequence. That's a genetic code. And then those of you who have had some biology, you know that before that genetic code can be expressed into a protein, it has to be copied into a complementary strand we call RNA. So we do that, and the RNA looks like this. And each of these triplet codes for an amino acid, parts of the protein. So when it goes out into the cytoplasm of the cell, we get this linear sequence of amino acids that, because of their individual chemistry, can fold up in a way that gives it biological function. This is actually part of the genetic code of the human hemoglobin protein. And this is the part about music that we can't do because we don't have the speakers. Okay? Alright, you see where I'm going with this then? We think we know what random is, but do we really? My brother is a software engineer, works for a wireless communications company in Lynchburg, Virginia, and they have a lot of government contracts for the military, and part of what they have to do is they have to do these zeros and ones in such a way that they can hide the key words within the randomness. But the problem is they can't find a good source of randomness. And so there's this thing called pseudo-random is what is used. Even in your math classes, you might have someone say, well, I'll do a computer program to make a random number generator. But is it really random? Because someone wrote an equation that would put out a certain string of numbers, so maybe it's not completely random. So do we really understand what random is? You see, because maybe it's less a character of the individual entity itself and more a character of the intelligence of the person or the individual who's looking at it. And if that's the case, then a superintelligence, i.e. God, would know no randomness. Everything, regardless of its deep complexity, would make perfect sense to him. Randomness and evolution need not be seen as purposeless processes, and they need not detract from belief in God. So, fundamental questions. Does the creative logic revealed by science demonstrate the existence of a creator? Can we be honest? Maybe. But maybe not. It's consistent with, but it doesn't prove. You know, this is science. Science cannot prove the existence of God. It's consistent with. Does the existence of innately creative natural laws, as Dawkins says, eliminate God from the picture altogether? Can we be honest to all of our students and our friends and our non-believers and say, maybe? Dawkins could be right. We could be wrong. We don't believe we're wrong, but he could be right. I think, however, there is more evidence for number one than number two. Okay, because if one claims, as Dawkins and his ilk do, if they claim that the random natural laws of nature are responsible for evolution and that therefore disproves the existence of God. If natural law is all there is, it begs the question, doesn't it? Who created the natural law? Who wound this whole thing up with just the right combination of physical and chemical properties that would allow it to unfold the way that it is? Amazing. I talk to my students about this and how delicate this is. This is a great room, big room, and I say, think of life in a scale of time from the beginning of time to present, one end to the other. And all the different possible physical constants that are part of gravity and atomic physics and biology, everything, are sequestered within this room. And the only combination of physical and biological properties that will result in life exists on a little thin fish line that runs from here to here across time. And any time any of the physical constants get outside of that domain along the transfer through time, life stops. So the only thing that we can see that is compatible with life has to stay within those confines. That's pretty amazing to me, because that's what we observe. Only certain physical constants will be compatible with life. But I think in terms of our credibility in speaking, we have to be honest about this. We can't say, well, no, science proves the existence of God. We will not be credible to non-believers if we say that. Okay? We can say it's consistent with, and it's my belief. And if they say, well, no, science proves there is no God, they say, wait a minute, no. You stepped outside the boundaries of science if you say that. And if you say that, then who created those laws that make that happen? I mean, there's a stronger argument for our belief. So a new direction is needed, one that is win-win. Stephen Covey wrote the book, Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, and in there he's really big on win-win stuff. And so that's what I'm trying to do with this concept of random design. Random because it accurately, scientifically describes how God has created and is creating this world. It's true, but it's not purposeful. Design. So random gives the secular science everything it says it wants. The truth, as science reveals it. Design keeps God permanently in the equation. Okay? So we need win-win. What do each side say they want? The scientists say they just want to pursue truth in science, physical, biological, wherever it leads. The Christians say we just want to keep God in the picture. Random design gives them that. We need to commit to solutions and set positive examples. This is hard for me, you know, because if you're trying to stake out, there's two extremes in our country. The six-day creationists, which are very strong and vocal and well-funded, and then you've got the very staunch secular atheists, and you have the two extremes who are doing all the talking, and the middle ground is being neglected. And so here I exist, right in the middle, saying we don't have to choose one or the other. We can find some compatibility in the middle. And you know, it's sort of like going down a freeway. You're walking down that center line and cars going by 90 miles per hour, 170 miles, kilometers per hour. Is that fast? Both ways. People in the middle tend to get run over. And so that's why you haven't heard a lot about this middle ground from Christian scientists and even Christian theologians. They don't want to get run over. And I can speak from personal experience, if you walk there, you will get run over. Yeah. But I have to set a positive example. Because if I'm in the classroom and a student comes from a very conservative background and either lashes out at me or is disrupted in some way, what good does it do if I attack back? So, you know, I guess I've decided, I think the Lord has revealed, the best way to handle this thing is to set a positive example. Just continue to speak the truth as best as you can discern it. And just keep going forward and, you know, let the extremes talk and attack if they want. As long as God provides enough armor and thick skin so that you can continue to survive and exist emotionally and all that, then we'll keep on talking. Nope. The other thing is, it kind of goes with number one, strengthens both science and religious belief. We need something that recognizes the role of language and emotions. We've talked about that. And finally, respect individual understanding and diversity. I suggested this earlier in my class. I tell them, it's so easy for me to do, but hard for them to get. But I say, it does not matter where you are at. In this class, I say in this group, wherever you are at, if you are an atheist, if you are an agnostic, if you are a nominal Christian, a liberal Christian, a conservative Christian, in my perspective, it's okay. Everybody starts where they start, and we're not all at the same place. And so let's commit together to work towards middle ground or understanding that makes sense both from the world of science and from faith. Okay, so random design is my proposal. Defined here, a powerful process for creating higher order, especially in living beings. It harnesses the laws of randomness and functions by first generating large arrays of potential building blocks from which the most suitable candidates are sequentially incorporated into an ever-advancing architectural design. Now, from a biological perspective, you'll see that is evolution. But random design works in other systems too. But from a biological perspective, it's evolution. But you see what it has done. Instead of saying we will claim just certain things for God, we claim it all for God. Have you heard of intelligent design? Okay, this is the weakness of intelligent design in my view. Intelligent design works like this. It says that what we will do is we will look at the deepest complexity of biology that we can see, and if we find something that we can't understand that could arise through the evolutionary process as we currently understand it, we will then insert God there. You know, the classic example was first thrown out there by Michael Behe, the bacterial flagella. Involves several different proteins interacting together. You can see the problem with this already, can't you? Because this is the way science works. What we can't operate on the position of what do we not know today, and we'll throw God in there. Because the way science works is what we don't know today, whether it be tomorrow or next week or next month or next year, it becomes understood. So then what happens to this place that we inserted God to explain biological diversity? God gets erased. So then they set up a new one. Well, here's a new biological process that we can't explain today through evolutionary processes. So therefore, we'll throw God in there. And then that gets explained. And then we pick up a new one. Do you see what we're doing here? We're setting up an absolute... it's getting pretty strong here. We're setting up a paradigm that guarantees that the cause of faith is going to lose. My question is, why would we ever want to do that? First of all, it's not true, and second, it's not necessary. I have a better idea. Why don't we just claim it all for God? God is the author of all creation, those things that we understand, those things that we do not understand, and we're open to let Him speak to us both through our minds and through our spirit. So I think that's the weakness of intelligent design. Someone has asked me, is random design intelligent design? And I say, well, I actually have an article I passed out here, you can see it. Well, it is kind of, because I believe that there's a designer, okay, and I believe that it's an intelligent designer. But I say, if it's really going to be intelligent design, it needs to be intelligent. And so I describe random design as a more intelligent design. One that allows God to reveal himself through his world freely without having to put muzzles on the process. All right, two more slides. Okay, strengthening science. Random design is a new model for trying to put things together. First of all, it recognizes that science must be free to pursue truth wherever it leads. It can't be subjected to religious veto. Second, it refuses to redefine or compromise the integrity of science to meet religious standards. It can't, or else it's not science anymore. Third, it does not explain biological processes and mechanisms of supernatural. Listen carefully now. This is for me. It does not preclude the supernatural. It just doesn't rely on that first. Okay? As soon as it does, it steps outside the boundary of science. Also, it's important for strengthening the case for religious faith. If the only options that our next generation are given are six-day creationism and Dawkins atheism, many of them are going to end up being non-believers. I think that's tragic. So what random design does is it provides a permanent, secure place for the plausibility of a creator. It doesn't provide proof. Science cannot prove God. The moment that it did, wouldn't we have to redefine God? It's supposed to be unknowable. Okay. Second, it's ecumenical, offering a larger, more expansive vision of God as creator. Third, it restores credibility of religious representatives. Now, I consider myself a microbiologist and an immunologist, but I guess in this context here in Australia tonight, I'm a religious representative, as well as a science representative. If there's any scientists here in the group tonight that know the genetics, you know, someone identify themselves as a microbiologist, if I've said anything here tonight that is not true, scientifically, what right do I have to expect that you would ever want to listen to anything I say to you regarding matters of faith? I'm not credible. Fourth, provides a viable framework or platform to restore trust and relationships. I've seen far too many relationships hurt and damaged and destroyed by this controversy that's going on. Count your blessings that it's not as bad here as it is in the U.S. I have had students in my office crying. I had a really strong, robust young man a couple of years ago. He's really smart. I mean, he's gifted intellectually. And he's only a sophomore, second year college. And he's in my office and he's crying because he comes from a fundamentalist family who have told him that if you believe in evolution, you're not a member of this family, you don't believe in God, you don't believe in the Bible, and you're not really a full member of our church. So, you know, he's torn because he's being told to choose your brain and what you fully understand. He understands the science. He's being told to make a choice, and it's got to be one or the other. I'm not surprised, I'm disheartened, because he left our school that year and went to the University of Illinois. And I actually talked to his father a year later, and I asked him for his email address so I could try to stay in touch with him. And I emailed him two or three times, he never responds back. But there's been all kinds of the drugs and other, I mean, he's given up. Because the options he was presented with were untenable. So can we do a better job of speaking with credibility from the Christian side of the equation? Can we speak the truth in love? One of the articles I have there, if you hadn't get one, help yourself. If we speak the truth in love, will people not respect that? I find that my students do. Okay. Let's finish up here then. When Einstein first proposed his thoughts on relativity, he was questioned regarding the theological implications of his ideas. And he responded with a legendary statement. He said, "God does not play dice with the universe." And we all shake our heads. Yeah. And these things are taken as the final authority on the matter. After all, these are the words of Albert Einstein. one of the most brilliant minds of our time, right? But given the explosion of information in genetics and molecular biology, you've seen just a bit of it tonight, and a better understanding of how life really works, could I suggest that perhaps Einstein was wrong? Born of an unexpected and delicate dance between randomness on one hand and order, chance and choice, contingency, uncertainty, we don't know everything for sure, and necessity, certain things have to happen. From these things emerge incredible biological structure, order, beauty, meaning, purpose, and even us. So we see then that in a very real sense, maybe God does play dice with the universe in the sense that randomness is a part of his tools, his toolkit. But once again, hang on, because just as we said before, there is much, much more to the story. You see, I do not believe that we can legitimately preclude the possibility that God's dice are loaded. In the sense that randomness can be used for a positive purpose. And if this is the case, then the ultimate outcome of this little fish wire that has progressed through time has never, ever been in question. Elizabeth Barrett Browning is one of my favorite poets. She pens some words that go like this. She said, "Earth crammed with heaven, and every common bush afire with God. But only he who sees takes off his shoes. The rest just sit around and pick blackberries." It's been said that the highest intelligence always involves an element of mystery and paradox. Indeed, as we have just seen a bit of tonight, the destructive laws of randomness are indeed the very same laws that fuel all creation. So I invite you to join me as we explore and probe the deeper levels of God's creation, learning to try to bring peace to God's revealed word and God's revealed world. They're both his creation. I hear say that there be sharks and dolphins and sailboats and many, many other wonderful, wonderful secrets just waiting to be discovered. Thanks for coming.